I am very excited to be here with you. As some of you know, I was originally, the choice was going to be for me to open up the series last year. Since I already had a commitment, it was impossible, and therefore Ari, in his indomitable, persuasive way, asked me if I would join you for year number two. And I'm happy. That was the first thing. I'm on a sabbatical year. That was the first thing I blocked in because of what I had heard of the success and the outpouring of the crowds, the hunger and the enthusiasm for study that you, the patrons, the sponsors, and the community in general evinced during the first year. I had already opened up a similar program in Houston and one in Chicago. And I thought this was a wonderful challenge to be here with you in Orange County. So I want to thank all of you, in particular Ari and the rest of you, for making this possible, but in particular for your desire to study, to learn, to increase your knowledge. And that's what I wish to share with you during this coming month. But before I do get started, I cannot... But react to the introductory remarks of the family physician. Where is he now? There in the back row, in all of his modesty. For those of you who are at the dinner, you heard the wonderful tale. So I will share another one with you that you can use to introduce the speaker next year. But you could claim it's your own. It's in the same venue, and the story is like this. What did Eve do the first night that Adam came home late? And the answer is, she counted the number of his ribs. My friends, what I wish to do with you this evening on our keynote address is to actually introduce you to the various fields that we'll be studying together, and I hope many of you take up Ari's invitation to join our classes, whether in the afternoon, whether in the morning, whether in the evening, just to be together and to study together. Some of the classes will be intensive study of text. Some of them will be formal presentations. Some of them will be more informal. You're all invited, and I hope I get to meet you personally throughout the coming month. The study of Bible is a very intriguing field. You already heard from Rabbi Altshuler how it increased and expanded his mind and his understanding. And as I said last night at a small gathering that we had, I feel that so many of you have been cheated because you have concluded your study at a very early age in life, bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah, and never were attuned to a sophisticated approach of how we study Bible today and its significance for us today, using all of the scholarly material at our disposal. And as I mentioned last night, that if one wished to be a graduate student in the Department of Bible at the Hebrew University, you have to come not only with a knowledge of Hebrew, but you'd have to know a bit of philosophy, psychology, sociology, comparative religion, archaeology. You have to know two ancient languages, not including biblical Hebrew, and two modern ones, not including English. So you probably say you have zilch number of students in your department. Well, in our university and in the other universities in Israel, we have more students studying for a BA, MA, and PhD in Bible than all of the universities put together in the United States, not including seminaries or theological schools. More. Why? There are several reasons. One, of course, is that we're in an age that we're all seeking our roots. And when we seek roots, we ultimately get back to the book of books. But there's another reason. Anyone who has an inquisitive mind, anyone of an intelligent factor that wants to know, realizes the many and varied interdisciplinary fields that one must master in order to begin the study of Bible. All that I mentioned to you is just preliminary. It's a prologue to the beginning of the study of the Bible, of opening the book of the Bible. You have to come encumbered with all of this background just to get started. So what I want to do this evening is to channelize all of those disciplines into one verse. That's all. Into the verse that everybody learned from kindergarten on, Bereshit bara, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And if within the next some odd minutes I can teach you how much you do not know about a verse you thought you knew, what about all those other verses that you know you don't know you know? But if you say, I came out on this balmy Orange County evening to learn only one verse, I'll teach you two. Get out, says God to Abraham in chapter 12, verse 1. And he points the direction in which to go, to the land of Canaan. But the Bible never tells us why the command was given to leave his native household. What I'm going to attempt to do this evening, very briefly, is to show you, if you understand the reason for the first great migration in human history, the first great exodus in human history, you will understand the innovation of, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Therefore, what we're going to do is to show you how 12:1, get out, is going to explicate and illuminate 1:1, in the beginning, God created heavens and earth. And how will we do it? Well, we know from where that get out command came. The Bible tells us that Abraham, before his name was changed to Abraham, lived in the city of Ur. And Ur is very close to the Persian Gulf. And the city of Ur has been excavated, just as dozens of other cities through which he passed on his way to the land of Canaan have been excavated, to such an extent that we know more about the time and the place of Abraham and Sarah than we know of many, many topographical sites in the medieval days. It has been, and now we know, tens of thousands of tablets, all written on clay, all written in what we call the cuneiform script, have been uncovered from the time, from the age of Abraham and Sarah. You see, when the Bible tells that command, Abraham and Sarah have reached 80. What about their youth? How were they raised? What did they study? Where did they go to school? The Bible tells us nothing about the childhood, the teenage, or the mature years of an Abraham and a Sarah. But now we can reconstruct it with the aid of these tablets. And that's what I'm going to do for you this evening. And I'm going to do it in a very novel way. I want to take you back to the time before the get out command was issued, before the first Hebrew, before the first Israelite, before the first monotheist. Because if you leave something, you have to understand, why are you leaving? You don't leave a place, a family, without a reason. And what we will see if we go back in time is why he left. And the reason for his leaving will give us the understanding for the first verse of the Bible. And how we're going to do it, I want to do it in a novel way. I want to reconstruct the age of Abraham before the command. And we will do it in the form of inventing a university. Now, you see, the land of Ur is in an area which was called in ancient times Mesopotamia, surrounded, circumvallated by two major rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates. And he's going to traverse this entire length before he comes over to Canaan. So I want to go back and invent a university. And for this evening's lecture, I'm going to call that university the U of M. And we will see what he and his wife Sarah would have studied at the U of M. Now, everything I'm about to tell you is documented on clay tablets. The only thing which is a fiction in the discombobulated mind of the present professor is the university. Never existed, but here is what they would have studied. And Abraham and Sarah are now seated with you. And with the permission of the sponsors and the patrons, I want to take you back to the U of M. They're seated amongst you, and in 15 minutes, they're going to have something to say. Let's go back in time and see what they would have studied. But we're going to do more than that. I will let you select any field of study you want, and I will tell you what you would have studied then. So pick a field. There's always one like that. Mathematics. Okay, they will tell, and of course, because Ari has said that I cannot speak more than 3.5 hours this evening, I'm going to have to be very, very brief in each one. First of all, in mathematics, something that you've never paid attention to, because really you don't have to pay attention to it, that in English, the value of a digit is dependent upon its position. If I write this, I have a 3, but then it becomes a 33, and then it becomes a 303. A positional valuation of a digit is the contribution of Mesopotamia. And if you lift your eyes up on high, by the way, something else. The Mesopotamians were the first people to invent a digit for 0. And you have to be a genius to invent something for nothing. It was lost, rediscovered by the Muslims in the Middle Ages, but 0-digit factor is a Mesopotamian contribution to world civilization. And if we lift our eyes up on high astronomically, and note I say astronomically and not astrologically, the Mesopotamians in the time of Abraham already knew of 5 of the planets of Mercury, of Mars, of Jupiter, of Venus, and that's way before Galileo. And tablets have recently been discovered, verified, and authenticated by NASA, showing us that the Mesopotamians were able to predict eclipses of the sun and the moon 50 years in advance. And those tablets were written in 1700 before the Common Era, at the time upon which we predicate the existence of Abraham and Sarah. Mathematics. What I want to try to show you, whichever course you're going to select, is that we're not talking about a donkey-back civilization. We're talking about one of the most sophisticated civilizations in the world at the time of Abraham. Pick a course.
Philosophy.
We are going to deal with that when I have this overall course together towards the end. I'm sorry?
History.
The first historical documentations come from Mesopotamia. And by the way, there are 2 different types. There are annals, that means the documentation of year to year of the king's campaigns. And then after 10 or 15 years, they're put together. They're called in English chronicles. The first documentation, historical documentation of in the world, come from Mesopotamia, and they are accompanied by, for anyone who wanted geography, the first maps of the world. Continue.
Language.
We now have, first of all, let us just backtrack for a second. The greatest gift of all is the gift of writing. We are who we are because we write. History begins with writing. And writing was invented by the Mesopotamians, my friends. 200 years later, we have hieroglyphs in Egypt. 1,500 and 1,000 years later, we have Indian and Chinese writing. The earliest writing, which comes from before 3,000 before the Common Era, over 5,000 years ago, Mesopotamia. Language. The earliest dictionaries in the world come from the U of M, from the time of Abraham. And now we have dictionaries which are unilingual, bilingual, trilingual, and we just discovered a quadrilingual dictionary. You have your word, and it is then explicated and explained in three additional languages. The introduction of schools and writing and dictionaries and encyclopedias from the time of Mesopotamia, from the time of Abraham. Why did he leave? Take a course.
Medicine.
The earliest medical texts, of course, come from the U of M. We now know that the first cranial lobotomy in the history of Mesopotamia took place at the U of M Medical School. And as usual, the operation succeeded, but but they were able. At the time of Abraham, cranial lobotomies. We now have medical texts which give us the name of the sickness, the symptoms and the remedies. Most of the remedies are herbal, so what's new? And now, in some medical schools, they are trying to apply those herbs to see their beneficial contributions. The School of Medicine. My friend, we can go on and on. Let's take a course in music. Now, I'm not saying that 25,000 years ago, people didn't. However, the earliest musical text in history with notes was discovered, deciphered, translated, transliterated, and transcribed by a friend of mine, a female Assyriologist at the University of Berkeley. And with her penchant for Simon and Garfunkel, she recorded it and called the record Sounds from Silence. And there was a concert held from Berkeley to New York of the earliest recorded music on the original instruments. And how do you get original instruments? First of all, you excavate and you find musical instruments. But then, when scholars and archaeologists went into Ur, where Abraham was born, they found a mass cemetery. And on the sarcophagi, on the coffins, there were pictures depicting musical players and their instruments. Scholars reconstructed a building afresh, and a concert was held. Why did he leave? Architecture. Well, my friends, if you want to know the psyche of a civilization, study its architecture. You could say, well, look what they have. They have something in the South that we meet every once a year for the Super Bowl at the U of E. They have a gigantic pyramid. That is correct. We have something else. It's called a ziggurat with a double Q. You can find it in your Webster's in Oxford, which is called, of course, the Tower of Babel in the Bible. What ultimately was a pyramid? It was one grand mausoleum to unhouse a dead pharaoh. In other words, the climax of Egyptian architecture culminated in the essence of death, whereas now we know what the origin of a ziggurat was, a temple tower of 7 floors height. The top had a little shrine. The bottom was a place where a human being could meet. It was the umbilical cord between heaven and earth where a human can come in contact with his or her God. We now know it was an ancient cathedral. In other words, the climax of Babylonian understanding of architecture was life and not death. And if you say, but it doesn't say that in the Bible about the Tower of Babel, of course it doesn't. Maybe we'll have a chance to discuss it another occasion because the Bible is leveling a parody. But look at this, a cathedral on high. Why did they leave? My friends, we could go on and on, but I want to take you to the most favorite course of all. And that was the course in Complete. And there you would study the bestsellers of yesteryear. And since we're dealing with the beginning, let's see how they spoke of the beginning. And their story goes as follows. In the beginning, there were two bodies of water, a sweet body of water and a salty body of water. The sweet body of water, as all the gentlemen folk here know, was the reincarnation of the male god. And the salty, briny, sticky body of water, as the other half would not like to know, was the incarnation of the female goddess. Well, the sweet water's water interwatered with the salty water's water, and by a biological process, I think doctors call it today waterification, there is a subsequent breeding and creation of gods until you have, after all of these generations, you have rebel with the cause. And what was the cause? The younger gods, all day and all night, are rollicking and frolicking. And the elder gods, who went out in early semi-retirement, couldn't get their sleep. So they decided to put an end to the young generation. Does it sound Freudian? Of course it is. You see, Freud gave us the terms, but they are already inherent in these epic tales. The elder gods want to castrate the younger gods. And the story, the epic tale, has two rounds. And the second round, we'll skip to the second one. It says that this salty water goddess, her name was Tiamat, decides to put an end to all this raucous clamor. And Tiamat is a hideous, horrible, horrendous, horrifying monster, the likes of which you read in the Grimm fairy tales. Every time she opens her mouth, flames of fire zap forth. The younger gods are scared stiff. There's advanced technology. There's advanced weaponry. They're about to throw in the towel when all of a sudden it dawns upon them, why don't we, and you'll pardon the anachronism, in David and Goliath fashion, select our champion, and they turn to Marduk. And they say, Marduk, tell us, are you willing to pick up the cudgels? Are you willing to face Tiamat in a duel? And Marduk says, when I defeat her, you see, youth does not say if. When I defeat her, you will make me numero uno, head of the pantheon, chief of the god. They say, Marduk, if you can defeat her, you are our chieftain. Well, Marduk is a very clever god, and he comes arrayed with two weapons, one defensive and the other offensive. First, the defensive. Marduk wants to have something which will protect him against anything that is thrown, tossed, hurled, or shot at him by Tiamat. So he puts between his lips a red potion, which is magical. Remember that. We'll get back to it shortly. Arrayed with a magic between his lips, he then takes the offensive weapons, the four winds, north, south, east, and west. Why? Marduk knows he's fighting a woman. And being a woman, she's bound to open her mouth. And when Tiamat opens her mouth with a blood-curdling attack, she gets as far as... He takes the four winds, shoves them down her maw. Her belly becomes distended, and then very artfully he says, touché. And he rips, and he rends, and he threshes, and he pulverizes... Kills her dead. But just to make sure she's totally demised, he takes his trusty sword and he splits her in twain. Mark in twain. Then, well, half of the body split, sets it up on high, and occasionally, but only very early in the morning in Orange County, it drips down upon us. She was the water goddess. Second half, the world is created. All the gods surround Marduk, and they say, Hallelujah, Marduk. Marduk, thou art our king forever and ever. But Marduk, are we not gods? He says, of course you are. Then if we're gods, why do we have to feed ourselves, dress ourselves, parade ourselves, put ourselves to sleep? Marduk, create for us a butler. So they said, fine. Who seduced Tiamat to come out and do battle? They said it was the husband's always at fault. They bring the husband god once again sliced in two. And from the blood of a slain male god, man, the butler, is created. This entire epic ends with one great adulation of Marduk, and the screen closes. Now, every one of you of Emmers, read that story. But there was a couple in your class, your peers, by the name of Abraham and Sarah, who did something that a lot of university professors don't like. They started reading in between the clay lines. And what they discovered was going to open up a Pandora's box. Because when they were in high school, were they to have been asked, what is the most powerful, potent agent in the world? They would have said, the gods, the chief god, the sun god. But now they realize that the gods are born. And if the gods are born, the gods may die. And what was happening? The gods say, why do we have to feed ourselves, dress ourselves, put ourselves to sleep? What are they saying? And then they realized, if a god is born, if a god may die as Tiamat died, as her husband died, if a god has to eat and a god has to sleep and a god has to engage in his own sexual foibles, that means there's a power above that god. And what do we call that power? Well, what is birth and what is sleep and what is eat if not the laws of nature? Once they understood that the gods themselves are ruled, are subjected, are subjugated, are subordinated to other rules, the rules and the laws of nature, they opened that Pandora's box. Because if I were to draw for you a diagram of what the world looked like in those ages, we would see humans, and then gods, and then above the gods, there is a sphere. That sphere is called nature. Now, you can't see it, you can't touch it, you can't taste it, but it's there. It's just like this podium has height and weight and length and breadth. So the universe is tripartite. Humans, divine, and a supra-divine realm above the gods that rule the gods. The gods are not autonomous. The gods are not independent. The gods are not absolute. And by the way, it's the same system, just with change of names. I can say Zeus, I can say Jupiter, I can say Re, I can say Aton, I can say Marduk, I can say Tiamat. Once they realized that, I said the Pandora's box was open, because they realized there are other things up there. Number two, along with nature, is magic. In this corner is standing the chief goddess of the elder generation, Tiamat. In this corner is standing the chief god of the younger generation, Marduk. And yet, though there is no one more powerful than two of them, Marduk can stop her by a certain potion between his lips. If you know the right color, if you know the right incantation, you can control your god. Third, up there, along with nature and magic, is day, is destiny, is fate, is Moira, is Kismet. I'll share just another tale with you that you all know. No matter how far and how long he would have wandered, Oedipus would eventually have killed his dad and wedded and bedded his mom, because four generations before him, it was destined. Destiny rules. You can't change destiny. And even the gods are ruled by destiny. So nature, magic, destiny, and last but not least is time, for which I really don't have much time to share with you, except to say there were evil days when the gods dared not step out of their holy mountain. All of these, my friends, together, when we put together, show us that the gods are subjected, as I said, and subordinated to a higher power. I'm going to come back to that in a second. Now let's go down to the humans, and I want you to remember three things for 5 minutes. Number one, we said that after the world was created from the slain body of a female goddess, then they decided upon making a butler who was a man. In other words, at the time of creation, man was not in the blueprint. He is a PS afterthought. Number two, he is made out of the, composed of the blood, from the blood of a slain deity. And number three, his role is to be a butler. Get out! Why? Because in every area of the human existence, no civilization could compare with Mesopotamia. Whether art, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, whether art, whether architecture, whether medicine, whether astronomy, whether language, whether medicine, They were the tops. But in one area, and one area alone, Mesopotamia did not come up with a suitable solution. But that area happens to be the most important area of our lives. What do I mean when I say God? What do I mean when I say man? What is the interrelationship between? Get out! Because here you're not going to find an answer. And they left. And with their leaving, chapter 1, verse 1 comes into being. I'm now going to start this evening's lecture. Don't worry, I'm getting close to the end. In the beginning, let's take all of this now into that one verse. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. I want to start and ask you a very heretical question. So pardon, telling you it's heresy in the beginning. Why doesn't the biblical tale start like every other tale by saying in the beginning God was born? Too heretical? God evolved, revolved, evolved. Why not? Because of the end of the sentence. But you say the end of the sentence is in the beginning God created heavens and earth. My friends, that's the answer, but I want to teach you how. You see, in Hebrew, and in every language that you know and I know, there is a style whereby you can express a totality by taking two opposite ends. The opposite, polar opposites, are all-inclusive. You know dozens of examples in English. Can anybody give me an example? Two opposites which make a whole. Okay. Yeah, but that would be now from eternity. I want the opposite ends. Okay, but say beginning and end in a more poetic fashion. You know it's from? Very, okay, fine. Night and day, you are all the time. Very good. We just had a meal, literally, it didn't go, but from soup to nuts. Right? Soup to nuts. It's an entire meal. From alpha to omega, from A to Z. You know it? I'll see you through thick and thin. It's as clear to me as black and white. You got it? Two opposites that make a whole. You know it. Love and now. If I say in the beginning God created heavens and earth, they're two opposites. So let's translate that into simple English. In the beginning God created heaven and earth, meaning in the beginning God created all of the universe, all of the cosmos. Now get ready for the bombshell. Translated simply, it means in the beginning God created all of nature. So what? I'll tell you so what. Up until the time that sentence was written, everybody in the world believed in the beginning nature created God. The gods were born. For the first time in the history of world thought, someone stood up against world stream of civilization and said, world, you're wrong. It's punkt verkehrt. No, in the beginning, nature did not create God, but in the God, my friends, this turns out to be probably the most sophisticated sentence in the entire Bible. This is not anything of a Baba Misa. This is a gigantic mutation, a revolution, the likes of which very few have ever seen similar to in the entire world. By saying in the beginning God created nature, this is a slap in the face to the world thought. Or if I put it more poetically, according to world thought, according to polytheistic societies, nature and then God, that means God, the gods are connected to nature by an umbilical cord. They have to eat. Comes the first sentence of the Bible, snaps the cord, reverses it, and now we have an umbiblical cord. The umbiblical, don't look at it in the dictionary. The umbiblical replaces the umbilical. A whole new thought process is coming into being with what you thought was a seemingly simple, naive sentence. And therefore, this entire world thought was turned upside down. No longer nature above gods, and the same with magic. What type of incantation can I use? What type of a color? What type of a potion to influence God? Who determines the destiny of God? And look what happened with time. Instead of time being a dimension that God has to be afraid of, God sanctifies and hallows time. That's for another presentation altogether. What you have here is a total revolution in world thought. A whole new concept of God is coming into being. And this concept of God is now for the first time independent, autonomous, because he is no longer bound by any supra-divine powers. Everything has been reversed. And you have the birth of monotheism. Now let's get down to man. And I use man not in a sexist way, because in their story, they're only talking about the creation of man. And I ask you to remember three things. Number one, that man was an afterthought. P.S. Hey, Marduk, do us a favor and... And what happens here? As you all know, the first 5.5 days of creation are one grand prologue, one grand preview to the creation of the pièce de résistance, which is man and woman. For the first time in the history of world thought, a human is the pinnacle of creation. My friends, this is the ultimate beginning of humanism. We gave it to the world, and we Jews don't even know it. For the first time, we set on a pedestal a human being and saying, for you, the world was created. And that's why the rabbis later on will say, he who destroys a life, destroys a world, preserves a life, preserves a world. Never said before. Not an afterthought, but the raison d'etre of creation. Number two, blood. If our bodies are composed of divine blood, that means we're partially, literally divine. So why be partially? Why not be entirely? And our sister religion of Christianity took the entirely. You see, once you say that within man literally is divine blood, then that man can become a god. What did the Bible do? The Bible said, yes, how man is created out of clay, but within that clay was infused and suffused and diffused divine breath. Divine breath, not divine blood. Which means, according to the Bible, man can never become God, but man must always act God-like, because it gave him a divine dimension. He has a divinity within him in the spiritual sense, not in the physical. And last but not least, well, if your God doesn't have to eat, why do you have to create a man? Here he's to be a butler. And once again, the rabbis got it head on when they said man was created in order to be a shutaf l'kadosh baruch hu b'maaseh bereshit, that man, you and I, were created in order to be partners with God in the ongoing process of creation. We are partners, not butlers. What a wonderful new idea. And that partnership was signed, sealed, and delivered at the foothills of Mount Sinai when an entire people became a covenanted partner with God. So, my friends, you see what's happening here? Get out. Get out. And that first human exodus was the determining factor in a whole new concept of God, a whole new concept of man and woman, and a whole new concept of the relationship. But it's told in what you thought was a simplistic manner. In antiquity, the Israelites didn't write postulates and axioms and presuppositions. They told tales. But within that tale is inherent the novel ideas which are now being presented to the world. All beautiful, all new, all innovative. And it's there. But you have to know how to read it. And you have to know on what background it's said. I want to conclude by telling you a midrash. You all know what midrash is, the tales of the rabbis. But you have to know, anytime you read a midrash, read it as though you're reading Agnon or you're reading Kafka. enjoy the narrative, but then ask yourselves, what made him tell that tale? What was he trying to get across? And this Midrash is saying exactly what I told you this evening, taught you this evening, but in its own poetic fashion. The beginning of the Midrash, I would say 90% of you know. The end of the Midrash, 89% of you know. The middle of the Midrash, none of you know. It goes as follows. The rabbis say that Abraham used to work in his dad's shop and his dad sold idols. One day, a man with one arm came in and requested to buy an idol with one arm. Abraham looks, and on the morrow, a man with one leg comes in and he wants to buy an icon with one leg. And then, according to the rabbis, Abraham says, you know, man is creating God in man's own image. One arm, one arm, one leg, one leg. So that night he takes the broom, all of the idols in his dad's shop. The next morning his dad comes to work, shambles. Abraham, Abraham, what happened? He said, Dad, you see that big bully God in the corner? It took the broom and... And his dad said, Abraham, I sculpt, that's wood and stone. I think for the first time in unrecorded literature, somebody said, uh-huh. What were the rabbis trying to tell us? That Abraham was the first great iconoclast because he smashed the idols and he smashed the idle thoughts of his day. And then, hearkening unto a call, get out! Abraham and Sarah left on a path that we, the children of Abraham and Sarah, are still walking on today. Thank you.